Studio computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for T1 at 20K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Leno Sanic. In this segment, we're speaking to filmmaker Jeff Carter. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, Len. Good to be speaking with you again.
Great. I think everyone knows you from your work on 50 Reasons for 50 Years, and then on various forums, you've written many articles. I think for Kennedy's and King, Jim DiEugenio publishes a lot of stuff that you've written. So thanks for that. Today, we have an announcement that there is a new documentary about Colonel Fletcher Prouty.
Correct, and it's our documentary. Long in the making. I think we've hinted over the years that this is in the works. And finally, over this last spring, we've finished it off.
Well, some things, I guess, are just like that. You know, you work on the project. I hear of people when they're said, oh, I've been working on this movie for 10 years, and you shake your head. And, then once you start doing stuff, you go, yeah, I can see that things don't happen overnight. And if you're not in a hurry, you go, well, let's do it right. Let's make sure we get everything. And so anyway, briefly, I think everyone listening to Black Op Radio has heard of Colonel Fletcher Prouty. But let me ask you, what was it that caught your attention about Colonel that inspired you to say, well, let's do something more? Like, we've did some of the episodes. We did 5-minute segments on him for 50 reasons for 50 years. And by the way, the 1968 and then the 2018, we did 9 episodes of that as well. We shouldn't let that go unmentioned. That was 4 on Bobby Kennedy, 4 on Martin Luther King, and then one that tidied it up. So that was very worthwhile, I think, as well.
I agree.
Okay, so Fletcher Prouty, you've heard of him. Probably heard of him from me because I've always, been mentioning he's one of the influential. I mean, I liked Fletcher Prouty. I liked Mae Brussel and Jim Garrison. Those three, I thought, were really had something to offer if you wanted to read their work, listen to them, and that. And tell me about what impressed you enough to decide to dig into Fletcher Prouty's background and do work on him.
Well, this project was certainly an offshoot of the 50 Reasons series, which is where we first met. And it was a long, year-long, probably even more than that, with the preliminary work we were doing. Let's say a year and a half where we were introduced and then did this kind of extensive project, which turned out very, very well, I think. At the end of the day. And of course, Black Op Radio was defined in a sense, at least initially, by your own personal relationship with Mr. Prouty. So through that relationship, you ended up with basically what we could say was Fletcher's archives, at least as relates to his career experiences in the United States military from World War II into the early 1960s. So you have this material there. And coming out of the 50 Reasons experience, I started mentioning that perhaps that material could form the basis for a documentary film. So that was the beginning, the kernel of an idea that started things. So it was basically we chatted about it.
No, if I can rephrase my question, I think I meant to say, what was it about when you listened to, you know, a lot of hours of Fletcher and this and that? What was the catalyst? What was something that you said, oh, like for me, when I heard him speak with Dave Radcliffe on his interviews, there just came to a point where I went, oh, this guy really was there. He was working around all those people. He really knows what happened. And somebody should write him and ask him. And that's what spurred me to write a question. But it was the thought that he really worked there. He wasn't researching somebody else's work, that he knew what was going on. And when I sent him a letter, you know, to ask some questions, you know, that's what sparked my interest. But that what caught me, so I'm just going to ask you what you think, what was it for you? But it was just the fact that he was really there. He worked in the Department of Defense. He worked very high up. I think he was in briefings in the Gold Room, one of the top 52 people, he said. You know, like, he was there.
I would say that through the interviews that have been accumulated and that you had put together, I think it's a series of DVDs, in the 2000s, yes, he was there. He personally participated. He saw and heard and came across things that you, in a sense, had to be there and active to accumulate this information. Because in part, he was sharing what could be described, let's say, in the late 80s, early 90s, when he was doing the interviews that we use in the film. He was providing counterfactual information in the sense that it was information that rubbed against the grain of mainstream or official history. And he wasn't just kind of some wingnut. He was actually in a position to speak authoritatively about those events. And as we know, since the record has been largely declassified, since that period of time, pretty much everything that Fletcher had to say about these events that would appear counterfactual in the late 80s, early 90s, has turned out to be absolutely correct. So that was fascinating. I think the fact that you had an archival record on hand, which included photographs, which included documents, and of course, these interviews, you became the kind of custodian of this interview record. That was a tremendous amount of material with which to work should one move forward. And I don't think we were moving forward. It was more just sort of an aspirational what if scenario for the first while. And I think you recall that we had kind of sketched out an outline on a chalkboard at Fiasco Studios, and it kind of sat there for years, that outline. And the outline itself is basically turned out to be the actual outline of the film we eventually made.
2013, I guess, right? The 50th anniversary. I'm pretty sure that thing sat there, you know, up on the wall, and it was, a dry erase thing. It sat there haunting me for years because every day I'd walk in, look up at it, you know, oh, we didn't chip away, we didn't do anything. But I think the fact that when we have done some of these projects, it takes an awful lot of work, you know, and it's not a financial gain thing, it's just a community service. Well, should I bother spending another year working on this? And by the way, I'm already doing Black Op Radio, so, you know, the odd time I try to make time to do other things, like we just did one for John Barber, but William Pepper, and that was kind of an effort that I made, and working with you on this one and some of the other things, right, as well as just doing Black Op Radio. But yeah, the thing I think that people are going to enjoy about this is you get to see the real background of Fletcher without, you know, it's just, there's quite a lot that he did. And when the Dave Radcliffe's interviews were called My Recollections of 23 Years of Service, you know, 9 of those are in the Department of Defense, but, you know, 23 years. So he worked his way up. back in the day when you did work your way up, and he was everywhere he said he was. And then when you look into it, he offers insight. And I think that the fact that he knew a lot more than he said, you would have to ask him, dig things out if it was getting too touchy. You know, he would say to me, you should study this guy. Why don't you figure out what that guy did for a living, you know? And that was a hint enough that, you know, he doesn't want to tell you. You dig it up and he'll either confirm it for you or not, right? That's what I enjoyed about him, that he had a great disposition. And he would talk to people that were interested in history and researching. And, I mean, hats off to you for, you know, kickstarting the project, because otherwise it would have sat there on the wall as a plan of, okay, the next thing is going to be this documentary. And it sat there for years, just not getting started.
Well, what I think in part kickstarted the film was the coincidence at the time, 2014, I think September 2014, was that Oliver Stone came to town. He came to Vancouver to do a day seminar. And you took the initiative, I believe, and contacted him and suggested, would you have, you know, 20 minutes or so to do an interview about Fletcher? And he graciously agreed. And we set up in a room adjacent to the theater where he was holding the symposium. And we're able to get him on camera for 20 minutes discussing how he was introduced to Fletcher and how Fletcher fit in to the making of the JFK feature film. So that kind of initiated things. And we had this very interesting 20-minute interview to start things off. I was going through all the archival interviews with Fletcher that were done in the early 1990s, early to mid 90s. And what I had sort of thought was, we should use as much material from these as possible and have Fletcher discuss the events and the interpretations of events as much in his own words as is possible. And that took a long time, basically. And I wanted to see how far a film could go just using Fletcher's own words. And it got us about two-thirds of a film, basically, from that material. After that, and this is some years later, to fill in the gaps, we did a series of interviews with yourself. And I thought perhaps we needed other people to come in and add their insights. But sometime around that era, we hit the COVID situation and kind of traveling to people became out of the question. And so we just worked with the interviews that you were able to provide, combined it with the interview with Oliver Stone, and then just our collection of archival footage. Everything could work finally. And we had a coherent feature film documentary out of that material. And and found the time to put the audio together. It's a very big job putting a project like this together, especially this one, because we were reliant on so much archival footage that basically had to be from the public domain. You had to search things that you could actually use in the film without stepping on someone's proprietary intellectual property. So that was a bit of a trick as well. And but eventually we could find everything, and I think it came together very well.
Yeah, I think one of the things we should mention, everyone, you know, probably listening knows that Donald Sutherland was for the Man X. Fletcher Prouty was the inspiration for that, and that's who Donald Sutherland played. When they called him X, it's you know, basically Fletcher Prouty. This documentary is not really about the JFK assassination and that day. It's really the background American military, and Fletcher, his observations of working, like he, I said, 23 years in the military and then 9 years in the Pentagon. And there's a real background of everything that Fletcher did. And it's a really good history lesson, I would say. And then if you didn't know too much about Fletcher, I mean, you could watch that just to learn about history and not really know too much about Fletcher, but you'll get both. You'll learn about him, but you'll learn about all these different operations that were going on. And he was rare that he would speak about some of these things, and they weren't big news. And I think nowadays, more people are interested in history.
That's true. And so, yeah, hopefully we can sort of join a larger conversation with this material. I think there's interest in the Cold War because it shapes our, let's say, postmodern world in profound ways, at least in the entities that were involved, which is basically the West and the Soviet Union at the time. It's not a global South story, except as they were affected, kind of like the smaller animals running through the thicket as the large elephants blunder their way across the terrain. But I believe at that time, in the late 80s and early 90s, Prouty had basically a speaking engagement presentation that he had worked up. And when these interviews that we were able to access were filmed, in large part, he was reiterating the content from his speaking engagement. And that is basically what he was talking about, was his Cold War participation and the Cold War history from his perspective. So there isn't a lot of material in that which is specific to the Kennedy assassination, which became more of a focus in the Black Op Radio. And when we use some material from these interviews for the 50 Reasons, that was the material that was more specific to that specific event. But this is a history documentary which basically covers, let's say, 1940 through 1963.
Right, and maybe we should tell people the title?
It's called Fletcher Prouty's Cold War.
Right.
Now, so I've stolen that title. Several people have used that kind of phrase in a different context. I think Greg Parker used it for an Oswald book. And so my apologies if we've kind of sort of muscled in on that title. But, you know, once it was kind of devised in my head, I was just like, well, we're not going to do any better than that. That's a perfect descriptive title. And so we used it.
And then the other good thing was that I really had been collecting everything I could on Colonel Prouty. And every time I went to Alexandria to videotape him, I kept all these things, so I have them. And, you know, John Judge and other interviews, rare ones. You know, that Bruce Kaner one is very interesting. And so he gave me a lot of actual paperwork as well. So there's stuff that nobody else really has, which you were able to make use of and put it in a good, coherent order of things. But, you know, anything that we bring up, there's paperwork to back it up.
That is true. Absolutely. That is true. The interviews we're working from, you could say, are, this is not a crew from CBS 60 Minutes going into Fletcher's house and filming him. Other than a few isolated examples, the mainstream documentary and news gathering weren't interested in this guy, because I think a lot of his material was at the time viewed as counterfactual, as I said earlier. So it was kind of a record that was of interest to people, but a small, out of the mainstream kind of audience. And the interviews can be very discursive, go off on tangents. So it was just taking the time to work through them and find all the different ways he describes the same scenarios across them, and then select the portions that were the best description and could flow together as kind of like we're working from 6 or 7 different interviews, but it all flows together as if it is one single entity. And Fletcher was also a very good talker. He had a particular way of describing things. He had a particular sense of humor that I think comes out. So it's not just kind of a textual drone. It's very engaging.
Yeah, there was just a kind of, again, history lesson documentary on the Bay of Pigs that I played back again a couple weeks ago on Black Op Radio, which was him describing, you know, from his office in there, saying this is what happened that week. You know, this is what really happened. And you can either accept it or not, but here's his point of view from where he worked and why the failure happened and who was responsible and what really went on. And I just find them interesting. And the thing is that, like you've mentioned here, the newspaper, the official, you know, mass media, they print a narrative. They have something they want everybody to go along with. And for those people that were working, you know, behind the scenes on some of these things, especially propaganda in the Cold War, they say, that's not what happened at all. I know that's what you read, you know, but that's not how it went down.
Well, let's take one example from the film is as Fletcher was a pilot working the North Africa area during the later years of the Second World War, and he had an assignment at one point to assemble a fleet of planes, fly to a remote field somewhere in Syria, and a train was going to come by, and it would stop, and then a whole fleet of American POWs were going to jump out of the train, and Fletcher's group would fly them to safety in Cairo, I believe. And his personal experience, his personal witness to this event allowed him to note that some percentage of these POWs were in fact German Nazi officers and intelligence agents who were intermingled with the POWs and were being flown out of Eastern Europe ahead of the advance of the Soviet armies.
Right, this Operation Paperclip, where Alan Dulles had designated some of these people we want working for us, they are defecting, they're in plain clothes, but he could tell they were high-ranking German officials that were just smuggled out at the same time. And yes. I mean, a lot of people have heard of Paperclip, right?
Yes. But that allowed Fletcher to make the observation that the Cold War, the ideological conflict between the West and the Soviet Union, had begun before World War II was even finished. This kind of, because in a sense, grabbing these German officers and sort of incorporating them into the military and intelligence systems of the United States was a betrayal of agreements that had been arranged with Stalin through the conferences in Cairo and Tehran. So that's not, or was not, mainstream understanding. So he goes on in the film to talk about particularly Galen, who was like the highest level of Nazi officer that was brought over and incorporated into the West's systems, the admission that this had actually happened by the Americans did not occur until the year 2000. That was the very first time that there was officially acknowledged that these events did in fact occur. And Fletcher was talking about this back in the 80s and early 90s.
And of course, people know about Dornberger and Wernher von Braun that were taken over and they were, you know, amalgamated into Nassau, but they were the heads of the German rocketry program. And that's just common knowledge. Wernher von Braun, of course, you just know his name. He's German, right? And that this is something that happened. But I think people were surprised just how many people were smuggled out of Germany and said, like with Galen, well, you know, you're a four-star general in the German army. Now today you're a four-star general in the American army. You're working for us now.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, that's one of many stories that feature in the film, and one of many instances where, you know, you think you know what happened, but here's what in fact did happen.
Right. Okay. Now, the film is about to be premiere. Where can people find out more information about this? And is it possible it's going to be shown this year in Dallas?
I don't know about Dallas.
Copa, and maybe in Pittsburgh.
Maybe I'm in Pittsburgh. Sure. We've had some conversations about that, and I think if that opportunity comes to pass, it'll be fantastic.
Yeah.
I don't think a movie is actually a real movie until it has some kind of public screening. So that's been arranged. It's going to happen Monday, August 12th in my town of Victoria, British Columbia at 7:30 at a smaller venue that's called Paul Phillips Hall. You can put the link, the upcoming screening link for that up on your show notes. So it's all scheduled to happen Monday, August 12th.
Okay, good. We'll put links to that there.
And we have a trailer that's been created that'll also be part of that link. The website for the film, at least the one I'm putting together, is in its infancy right now, but I'm going to be adding material to that over time. And so I think that'll be a great resource. And the concept for the film is that we should have it up as a streaming pay-per-view project. It won't cost a lot, but we'll try and recoup a little bit. There's been some money put into the project and, of course, our time. So that on the website will be clarified as we get closer to the August date.
Okay, good. Now, we've been just basically at arm's length over coffee here talking about what the film is. It's a history lesson from Fletcher Prouty's point of view from the end of World War II, I think, until, like you said, into maybe 63, 64, when he retired. And he'd had enough, and he retired January 1st, 1964. I think maybe, you know, Vietnam and the beginning of Vietnam and the Kennedy assassination were just the final straw, that he wasn't really into that business anymore. I mean, it wasn't his cup of tea. But the thing that people always ask me, well, how did he know so much? He worked for the Air Force, and he never had to sign an oath of secrecy to the CIA. And he said, we were the top dogs in the Department of Defense, and when the CIA was created, you know, they reported to us. His department, Team B, they organized when the CIA wanted to do clandestine operations, when they wanted aircraft, and when they wanted things done. They cleared it with his office, which was a couple of people in there. Army, Air Force, Marine, right? That's how he got to recognize all these covert operations that weren't in the news, but what was really going on around the world. I think the film brings that out, but that, in a nutshell, is how he got to know so much about what was going on, and that he was willing to talk to a few people because he didn't have to sign an oath of secrecy. And also, when he left the Pentagon, due to a little funny little incident, he got his secretaries to stop stamping everything with ultra-sensitive eyes only, this and that. He just said, when stuff gets in, we'll just file it. And then when he went to, you know, leave and retire and take stuff with him, it didn't say, some of these documents that he kept didn't have any classifications. So that if they checked him, oh, okay, well, this is unclassified, no problem, there you go. And he was in a high enough position that nobody else would know what some of these things were, other than him. But we're thankful for that we have some of these documents.
Yes, and that is a unique experience that Prouty had, and you're good to bring that up, is the fact that his classification, his oath of secrecy, was developed as part of his job with the Department of Defense. And when the CIA originally attempted to have him, you know, do the same non-disclosure agreement regarding them, he refused. He said, you know, I'm higher than you guys already, so I'm not going to sign anything. And that allowed him to speak more candidly about particular programs that he was involved with than he otherwise would have been. And that's why he was in such a unique position as he developed his books and articles and his speaking engagements later in his life.
Yeah, it really do you go into the story about the his secretaries in the film? I forgot. I mean, I know all these stories.
No, he discusses you discuss how.
No, I know. I mean, I just didn't want to duplicate it. So if I tell people right now if it's not already in the film.
Right, okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, no, it's totally fine.
Oh, okay. Well, one night his secretary was trying on a new ink pad they had, and she had all these stamps in the drawer, and she took out like a New York Times or a newspaper and started stamping eyes only, ultra sensitive, whatever, some of the other secret top secret, and then just stamped all over it. Well, he was at home and he got called at 3 or 4 in the morning and said, there's been a problem in your office, you've got to come down here. And he goes, you know what, right, there's a security breach. So he had to get dressed to go down there 4 in the morning. He said, what happened? They said, well, we found top secret documents in the trash. And he said, okay, show them to me. He said, well, we're not allowed to look at them, actually. He says, what do you mean? So he called some other guy to hire. They went down there. They saw that all this ultra-sensitive top secret was in a New York Times newspaper. And so he said, well, this isn't top secret stuff. What are you calling me down for? And then the guy said, listen, if we see something stamped like that, we're not even allowed to read it. We have to just turn it in right away. So he got a little bit of trouble. So then when he came back, he told the secretaries, just don't stamp anything anymore. If somebody breaks into his office, they'll have to go through everything. They won't know what to make of anything. So just don't stamp anything. And that's almost unprecedented, right? But so that's what happened. His secretaries got in the habit of not stamping documents that he had, and that's how he ended up with so many of them. And, of course, he was able to show me documents, and if you've seen some of the interviews I did at his home, he had quite an extensive library in his den of you know, the real goods, you know, whether it was the official story. Nowadays, we're really attuned to having a narrative where you watch, you know, CNN or some of these other stations, and they're just pushing a narrative, not the actual truth. And for those who are interested in what really happened, this is a rare individual. That's why I started collecting the stuff for the CD-ROM I put together for him, because I thought, my God, like, nobody else has this stuff, and we got to make a record of it somewhere. And I started scanning articles, and I put them together as much as I could for a CD back then. I turned it into like a DVD, 4.5 gigs, and now it's a direct download, even bigger. But this is a real story of someone who was there. And that's the other thing. Some researchers, people now that are researching, I don't think there's anyone else in Fletcher's league. Like, for instance, and no disrespect intended, but John Newman or some of these other people, they are researching. You know, back then, I'd say maybe McNamara was the only guy that wrote anything who was there. And other than Fletcher, when he wrote The Secret Team in 1972, he was one of the rare people who was there and wrote about his job firsthand and what he thought was going on in the world. And of course, he was, I think, warning people, just like Eisenhower was saying, you know, this industrialized military complex is going to be out of control. And I think that's what Fletcher's work in a nutshell was warning about the CIA, that they're bigger. And like Ed Snowden, in fact, when we met Oliver, he said, how do you want the interview to go? And I'd say, well, I'd like it to go like your movie on Edward Snowden, that you said here was someone who came to try to, you know, distribute to the public just what's going on. And it's not up to them to do any, you know, Snowden didn't say take up arms or do any. He just said, listen, I think you should know about this. And that was my impression about Fletcher. If anybody went to meet him or talk to him, he'd say, listen, I think this is really more important. It's darker than you think. And if you're wise enough to ask him questions about it, he would answer. But otherwise, he wasn't just, you know, just revealing everybody. But every now and then he would come out and say, tell a reporter something. And he had a quote. He said, I'm just trying to level the playing field. If I hear too much bull, I'll phone a reporter friend or somebody and say, you should study this guy. Or, you know, if you think that guy was doing something, he's working for the CIA. What are you talking about, right?
Right. And that's a very good point, Lynn. But just to clarify, I don't think you could call Fletcher a whistleblower because he always did respect his classifications and his status of what he could reveal and could not reveal.
Yeah. In San Jose, he was on a radio show one time and a guy really pressed him. He said, come on, you know, give us a name, you know, tell us something. And he just said, listen, without there being an official court case, without there being some kind of official record, me just blabbing somebody's name on a radio show is not going to do anything. It's up for people to make an honest, scholarly effort to look into, for instance, in the JFK assassination. I mean, if you want to study it, fine. But it wasn't up to him. I think maybe his biggest revelation was just identifying Ed Lansdale in Dealey Plaza, yeah, along with Victor Krulak. He doesn't say what Ed Lansdale did. He doesn't name him as a gunman at all. He just says very curious that this guy, you know, working for the agency, is there after he retired November 1st, October 31st, I think, 63. Anyway, you know, I mean, isn't that interesting? And if you leave it there, you say, wow, I better look into this further from that angle. Because here's a footprint that changes the whole thing. It's not Lee Oswald, it's not a lone gunman. You know, and today we have that assassination attempt on Trump, and you go, what the hell is that 20-year-old guy? How the hell did he get up on that ladder? How did he get a gun in there? How do they wait for him to take the shots and then shoot him? And of course, with one shot, then there's no questions, there's no trial, there's nothing. You know, like, anyway, that's a different topic, but you know, similar themes that something may be up more than you think. That when we talked to Oliver Stone, that was one angle I thought that he could compare, without being a whistleblower, Fletcher Prouty, to writing about a problem that when he had made the film on Ed Snowden, you know, Snowden was trying to tell people, look, I'm not in it for personal gain. It's not, I just really, you should know how much information and data is being stored. You're being attacked, really. Everyone's out to censor and change and put up a narrative rather than the truth. So that's what I have to say about it for now, I guess.
Okay. I think we've covered it. And then maybe at some point down the road, depending on the response to all this, we could do a follow-up program. You could do a follow-up program with Dave Ratcliffe or something. Because I think that your little personal stories of interacting with the man are fascinating. And I'm sure Ratcliffe has some of those too.
Yeah. Dave Ratcliffe is an inspiration. You see somebody like that that's trying to make the world a better place, and his radical.org website. His fantastic interview with Fletcher is what inspired me to even write a letter to Fletcher to start with.
Ah, that's interesting. Well, there we go.
Oh, yeah, 100%, because as I'm listening to that, that's where it got. Like, you hear Fletcher talking and you go, you know, my God, he knows. Like, what does anybody really ask him? And I thought, you know what? I'll pen a letter together that doesn't mention who killed Kennedy. Just how could this happen? You know, like we're saying, how the hell can a 20-year-old guy get a gun into a rally, get up on the roof, lay there for 20 minutes, not be spotted? Or, and it's, how could this happen? Other things are afloat.
Yes. I would say one of the fortunate things for what we needed to work with, these interviews that you had, the interviewers Dave Ratcliffe and John Judge and others are highly informed people just going into it. And that adds to the quality and the depth of the conversation. And we were very fortunate to have that record with which to work. I found telling the documentary, you couldn't just jump into a topic. It needed to be kind of contextualized and set up a little bit. And it was difficult to find means of doing that. And then eventually I came to realize that that sort of context I could find in little clips through these interviews, particularly from David Ratcliffe or John Judge, who they set things up properly. So there's portions of this where we're reliant on those individuals kind of setting things up. Dave Ratcliffe is very impassioned and informed. John Judge has a droll sense of humor, which comes out in these interviews. And you see that. And he was so articulate. And it really brought home to me what a loss John Judge's passing was to the community at large.
Yeah, along with everyone, you know, now Cyril Wecht and Fletcher himself and Mabe Russell and so many people. I think that, you know, I've been doing Black Op Radio a while. On my 1,000th show, I started looking back and over 50 people have passed away now. So wow. People who know about these Cold War stories or the Department of Defense, you know, and that they know what they're talking about, we've lost them. So... But there's contributions are on film, and that's the good thing that we've done for at least Fletcher here. The title Fletcher Prouty's Cold War, you know, his experiences of that
era. I'd say also that our interview with Oliver Stone basically clarifies in Stone's own words how Fletcher became involved with the JFK film and really what Stone's impression of the man was. There's a few things put out there since I think the meetup you had in Quebec City, which suggests that Oliver Stone has revised his thinking or somehow turned against Fletcher. And I think the film clarifies exactly what that situation really is.
Yeah. And it's, well, people waving a narrative around. So, like, you know, I always urge people, I say, listen, don't take my word for something. Why don't you just listen to what Fletcher said and, you know, and get it straight? Because especially now with politics, people are just putting words on other people's and then making a meme about it or saying something. It's just, you know, that's not what the guy said. And even though, you know, people are quoting something else, that's not what he said. So just listen to that. But I found Fletcher very smart, intelligent. I mean, that's how he got to the position he was in. And I've never been able to count that, but he said he was one of the top 52 people cleared for these briefings. So in the Pentagon of 35,000, you know, you've got to be on the ball to be up that high.
Absolutely.
And I found him a great disposition, very personable, that you know, that he would answer letters to people who were trying to get a scholarly reply. Because he certainly had some other people that were just going to waste his time and talk about this or that, the other thing. But if you came prepared, I mean, that's one of the couple of things that happened with me and my friend Andy Hill when we came to him the very first time. We had like a list of questions, prioritized our interview, and we know we had only so much time. But when we were leaving, he said he was really impressed with, you guys are prepared. You're not just, you know... So you've really, you know, used your time wisely. Let's keep in touch. And then, you know, after that, he gave me his fax number and just said, fax me questions. And we'll leave it at that because more is in the film. But
yes.
that was, I think, the good thing about Fletcher is if you were interested, honestly interested in history, he would tell you his story. And this is his story from his point of view, what he did and saw during those years of the Cold War. And if you're interested, fine. And if not, fine.
Yes, and you could meet him at the same level because he, as well, was extremely interested in history.
Well, once again, I think my interest was I just couldn't believe that I could tell there was a man who was there, worked there every day, who knew what was going on. He wasn't somebody who heard from somebody else and did some other operation or was just doing research on it. That was his office. And so he knew firsthand what was going on, you know, thanks to Dave Ratcliffe's interviews. And then, like you mentioned, there's many other people, the Bruce Kaner, John Judge, a couple other people. I just started collecting these interviews. And thanks to you, we put them together in a, is it 90-minute documentary?
Correct? No, just a little longer than that.
104
minutes.
Yeah. And it's just the whole thing is very educational. So that's what I'd like to wrap it up with, is to say that it's worth watching.
Okay. Well, I'm very excited that we're finally finished this kind of epic journey making this thing. And many thanks to you, Len, for your participation and providing the key elements to make this all work.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Like you mentioned in one of our episodes of 50 Reasons for 50 Years, it just, if two people got together and tried to do something, you know, me and you just, we weren't even lifelong friends. We just kind of met, you listened to the radio show and said, hey, I'd like to, you know, we'll work on something together. We did 50 Reasons. Then we did the 20 years, the redux.
Yeah.
Is that, yeah. Anyway, and now this compared to the mainstream media that just keeps parroting, you know, whatever you want to say, Putin is bad, Orange Man bad, whatever, you know, and I'm not sticking up for Trump. Trump, love him or hate him or whatever. I'm just, what is the real story in something? And where do you go to find out? I mean, Fletcher was rare, and the same with Ed Snowden. I just admired everything about Ed Snowden. Can you imagine? He left. He had to leave his country just to warn people, to tell the truth about something.
And well, he did. And that was quite a harrowing escape from Hong Kong, for sure. And I think you look at the example of Julian Assange, who was unable to escape in time and suffered tremendously because of it.
Yeah.
That was going to be Ed Snowden's fate if he didn't know the right people, which it turned out he did. I don't think he's happy in exile, but...
Well, the thing with Fletcher, he was at a different time. His book in 1972, 73, whatever, people didn't have cell phones everywhere. They didn't have the internet. So that if he wrote a book, it could just quietly sit on a shelf and it was like, well, nobody's reading it. Nobody's buying it. Let's just leave that alone.
Right. And that, but that process of the book becoming quickly obscure was kind of helped along by hidden forces, would you not say?
Yeah, and it only came to light, I think, through small radio shows like Mabe Russell and Dave Emery, who slowly, you know, years later, and then with the Oliver Stone film, people started to have an interest in history. Well, was this Warren Commission really crooked? What really went on, right? And, well, what else do you think went on in Dealey Plaza? And then you get into it, and, yeah, I have a pretty good 10-minute talk of Fletcher, which I put video to, about what he thought went on in Dealey Plaza. And that's when you start opening your eyes and go, oh, this guy knows these people, you know, without saying, this is what this guy did. He did that. He did, you know, it's just like, no, this was an operation that happened. Mm-hmm. And by the way, they do it in other countries. And here's where they train. And, you know, like it or not, that was what he witnessed.
Right.
Okay, Jeff, well, we'll keep in touch and send me a link for the theater in Victoria, August 12th, if anybody is in that British Columbia area and come to see it. Otherwise, it will be available on the web this fall. But I just wanted to have you on since it is going to be premiered and years in the making, but it's worthwhile. And congratulations, very good job. And it's just the two of us, that, you know, everything you've done with the 50 Reasons and the 2018 Redux, you know, it's been top-notch stuff. And I think when people look to what kind of documentaries have been done, you're right up there. And like I say, you just, it's amazing what two people can do. I mean, imagine if it was four or five people. Anyway.
Right. We had the benefit of time, and that's what ultimately informed the quality of the film.
Yeah, and you had the time to actually research everything just to double check. Like, you know, is this true? Because some of the things that Fletcher would discuss were, well, we didn't hear that in school, or I heard the opposite. Well, we'll leave that for the film to reveal to people.
Absolutely.
All right, then, Mr. Carter, thank you so much for your good work always, and thank you for taking time today to discuss this.
Thanks, Len. Enjoy the rest of your summer.
Okay, I will. Talk to you later.